Today's community conversation is with Bridie Harris, a contributing author for the Louisville Pride blog and host of 1.5 Femmes Against Fascism, a Facebook Live series. You can see Bridie's latest article, Queer Black Lives Matter 101, an introduction, on our website, louisvillepride.com. We'd like to thank the sponsors that make Digital Pride possible, UAW, Local 862, Republic Bank, and Norton Healthcare. We had a few problems with the audio while recording this episode. It's a little easier for us to edit the video than the audio, so we've left it as is so you can enjoy some delightful outtakes. Welcome. We are here with Bridie Harris, who is getting her PhD in Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville, and previously has gotten her master's degree in theology and ethics. Yep. Is that correct?
Yep.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining me today. Bridie has written an article for our new blog we've started on the Louisville Pride website, Black Queer Lives Matter 101, an introduction. And this is part of a series we're going to do of just kind of queer theory 101, just getting some of the concepts out there, sharing with people in maybe a little more everyday language than we sometimes get. Personally, I think there's a gap sometimes between the academic LGBTQ world and the rest of the LGBTQ world. And it's, there's new terms, there's new concepts that are developed and are shared within certain communities, but are not, not known by the public at large. And I think like cisgender is an example of one that most people in the LGBTQ community know what that means now. A lot still don't, but it was, you know, it was definitely in academic and activist circles for several years before it was kind of gained more popular currency. So that's kind of the purpose behind that. And we're just going to talk a little bit about some of that and some of the other work that Bridie is doing. So thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. If you see me look down or to the left, it's because a really cute cat has popped up and I have to pet it as part of my dyke identity. You know, I've got to love on all of the cats that pop up, so.
That's totally understandable. If I suddenly mute my microphone while I seem to be in the middle of saying something, it's because there are some adorable dogs viciously guarding the house from the postal worker. It's gotten a lot worse during the pandemic because everybody on the street is ordering things from Amazon. You know, there's like four delivery trucks a day at least. Yeah. And so the dogs are like, we are seriously under attack. What's going on? And it's self-rewarding for them because they bark.
Oh, yeah.
And then the person leaves. And like, I saved the house again.
I'm glad that you had the introduction that you did because that's very, very true in terms of academia being sort of its own self-gratifying ivory tower, you know, and it's particularly interesting with departments that started out as these really revolutionary things that were fought for, such as Black studies, you know, women and gender studies, queer studies, gender and sexuality studies, all of these things that were hard fought, and then because academia is the beast that it is, it kind of gets subsumed. So there's always this tension of, are we the radical department in a, we think of academia as fairly liberal, but it's not radical by any means. In terms of being radical, it's very, very conservative and capitalistic and all of these things. So it's like, are we radical for being here, or have we lost some of that by becoming part of the academy? So things that started out as being all about the community, for the community, by the community, does get lost a little bit in when it joins a university kind of space. And then we do have these terms like cisgender or Latinx, or, you know, Latinx, where it's like, Are we making these things up? Are these actually being used? Are these useful? Are these self-gratifying? And I think the answer to all of that is probably yes. It's both useful and for some sort of not helpful at all, you know? So I'm glad that you started with that.
Let me ask you a question about that. And I don't know if this is one you'll have an opinion on or not. Latinx is one. Personally, I've struggled with this one because I think to me, it strikes me as very culturally chauvinist for me as a white person who's an English speaker to go in and fix somebody else's language. You know, your language is so gendered. Let me come up with a new term. Yeah. And the vast majority of Spanish speakers I've known in my life have not been members of the LGBTQ community and probably would not appreciate me rephrasing that. And so I don't know, I that's one that I kind of go around with how I feel about that term.
And I'm not Latina, so I don't have a perfect answer for that, but I will say that particular term I've heard for years in activist spaces by Latina community. So I sort of follow the lead there on that one. If others are saying it, then certainly I'm saying it, you know, in Latinx queer spaces. And that one too often is a little bit of a generational divide one too, you know, so I kind of just fall in step with what others are doing. But I've seen it being used by queer, genderqueer, non-binary, Latina, Latinx people. So that's kind of my vouch for using it. And certainly in the classroom, I use it with some of that preface that I just gave to you. You know, this is why I'm using it. To be inclusive, but if you are not of this community or communities, do follow as you are kind of told or shown.
And I think we sometimes think of these communities as being monolithic when they're not. Right. And there's obviously a correlation between people's preferred terminology in terms of African American or Black. Yeah. Or people of color, or Black and brown people. And there's all these phrases that are sometimes used synonymously when they're not synonyms. Yes. I think the
important thing to remember is just to decenter whiteness, you know? I mean, it sounds sort of basic, but you are gonna have very different viewpoints on Black, African American, people of color, Black and brown, BIPOC, you know, all of these phrases that you hear for race, culture, and ethnicity, not interchangeably, but some of these used for all three, certainly. So the important thing for me is to not use phrases like non-white, because it's like, okay, we exist outside actually of whiteness entirely. So there's no need to identify us as the other thing that's not white, you know. Same for, you know, genderqueer and trans people, which I belong to that group as a genderqueer person, is like, it's not non-cis or like, you know. And then for brown people as well, to make sure we're not just saying, you know, these blanket terms that really are attached to whiteness, such as Hispanic or, you know, any other kind of term that's still mostly speaking about a European sort of identity claim or in opposition, and where whiteness is still sort of being held high.
Whiteness is the default.
Exactly.
That everything's kind of built around or right. Responded to.
Right.
I think of I remember learning in somewhere along my academic career a professor talking about the modern concept of atheism is still a very Judeo-Christian atheism, you know.
Yeah.
And which is fine, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's sort of like, it's not just that there's an absence of a belief in God, it's an absence in a belief in this specific God. And that was kind of an eye-opening moment for me of how you can have something, even when it's not
even when it doesn't appear to be centered, it's still the zero point around which the whole system is built.
Right, right. I think we do that with like humanitarian kind of things too. Like, it's okay for you not to believe in the Godhead, the white male Christian Godhead of, you know, God the Father, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit, as long as you do believe in the values and ethics, you know, synonymous with that in the capitalistic Christian American sense, then you're fine in your efforts, you know? So yeah, it's all consuming, all of these things.
That's a little bit like, you know, it's okay to be gay, just don't flaunt
it. Gay. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're not talking about femme identities yet. I know you're planning to get there, but that's similar to how I feel about femness, where it's like totally acceptable as like the other thing, the partnered thing with some kind of masculinity, you know, but like two femmes in relationship together, or a group of femme best friends, or a group of femme lovers is like something like, okay, that's that, but it's not even real. It's not even thought of as valid in any way. It's almost not offensive either, only because it's like a non-thing. It's like, oh, there are those girlfriends, you know? There are those friends or those aunties that live together for 20 years.
Well, it's like the group of women can be, you know, out at a table and a guy can come up and say, are you ladies alone? Like, there's four right. people here. Like, no, they're not alone.
Right, exactly.
You know, that's, I want to talk about that and about queerness and some of this. But I've always thought that this kind of goes back to a conversation we were having earlier, but I feel like there's definitely this devaluation of femininity and femness and femme identities, and much more so than there is, well, I feel like there's been this movement not towards gender equality necessarily, but towards more access to the masculine sphere, you know,
correct.
Which does not inherently challenge patriarchy, because patriarchy is built on the idea that to be a man is better to be patriarchy is built on the idea that it is better to be a man than to be a woman.
Yes.
So naturally women would want to do manly things.
Right.
You know, that doesn't threaten the idea of patriarchy the way people wanting to do feminine things does.
Right. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You saw this in early women's liberation movement where white women's liberation movement, where the goal was to gain access to a white cis male heterosexual world, right? And capitalistic world. So the goals are being able to leave children in the house and go into the workplace and wear pants. And it's like, first of all, fuck pants. Why? What are you talking about?
We don't they have pockets.
Does it have, right. We want dresses and we want giant ass pockets. That's what we actually want. But nobody asked me in 1960 and 1970. They should have. I was coming just 15 years later, you know? But like, and then you see that repeat, I mean, you see that same kind of thing repeated in queer world, where it's like, we can do this, but it needs to be this butch femme kind of thing. And the femme is just kind of like an afterthought. It's a pairing, you know? And as particularly in gay men's world, where it's like, you may not even be gay as long as you're the masculine at the top, you know? So you still have access to this heterosexual, cis, male, masculine sphere. You know, so it's all of these things sort of repeating itself. And it's like, first of all, we need to actually recognize that all of these categories are part and parcel and after effects of white settler colonialism, racial categories, gender categories, categories of masculine and feminine, categories of class and capital. All of these things are direct correlations to patriarchal, white, the creation of whiteness, the creation of whiteness, because this is something that didn't exist, settler colonialism, you know. So we need to peel apart those layers and see it for what it is. Then we need to totally deconstruct what white settler colonialism created and go back to some other ways of being in terms of gender, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of what we value and how we value it. So it's not a question of how can marginalized communities join the oppressor class. It's a question of how do we abolish the oppressor class and go back to other ways of being and find new ways of being, going back in history and getting what worked and bringing it here and finding what can work now.
At the risk of being far too radical, you know, can the oppressors be part of that? I mean, I think that's the Marxist theory, essentially, that like, if you're benefiting from the power structure, you, mm-hmm. you know, and that's really what a lot of well-intentioned work, ally yeah. work in any sphere it amounts to. Let us help you into the powers that be, you know, we're going right. to help you get access to this system. But mm-hmm. if the whole system is wrong mm-hmm. and you're benefiting from it, it's really, really difficult to actually, to actually take action against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it really depends on the carefulness of our language. So those who benefit from an oppressive system can absolutely and must be part of this change and move forward with us. But those who decide that they belong to this class cannot, right? So we're not saying, or I'm not saying, because I'm just talking for myself, I'm not saying that individual members of the oppressive class, and class I'm using so broadly here, cannot move forward just because they benefit from these things. But they have a lot of work to do on an individual level to actively decide every second of the day to acknowledge the ways that they benefit, to disembark from the ways that they can remove some of that privilege, to leverage that privilege, to choose other ways of being, right? To actively be anti-racist, actively be anti-patriarchal, actively decide that capitalism is a harmful mode of operating, you know? So it's going to be a serious choice. So what we need to totally abolish is the systems, not individual people. And because American culture is so individualistic, that it's really hard to explain that to people because they immediately go into a defense mode. And that's when you hear things like, "I'm not racist, I'm a gay man. I was poor growing up. I couldn't possibly have white privilege, you know?" And it's like, we're not individually saying to you, Matthew, you know, or whatever, that your life has not been difficult. Actually, your life has probably been difficult because of the same systems that we want to rid ourselves of, you know? But we're saying race here particularly is not one of the things that is hindering you, you know, or ability, or, you know, whatever the categories may be. So to answer your question really longly, if longly is a word, yes, individuals must and should come with us, you know.
I want to shift gears here.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for that feedback to... to that. Let me ask you about the term queer. We were mm-hmm. talking about the term Latinx earlier. I've often thought the term queer is not necessarily the best umbrella for the LGBTQ community, because I think it implies a political identity. I think it implies a lot of a lot more information than just being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer questioning. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the term queer and the way it's used and when it's used by people who are not queer?
Yeah, there's a lot in that question. I think one thing that maybe is most important for me to note is that there are no modes of being in this world that are not political, that are apolitical. So if you kind of remove yourself from white educational lineages of feminism, of lesbian and gay rights, of lesbian and gay liberation, and those kinds of educations and histories that we know the most about, and look at some Black lesbian feminist sort of writings and lineages like my Lord and Savior Audre Lorde, you'll see repeatedly that just existing is a political sort of statement, taking self-care is a political statement. Every language and word, languaging and word that we use is a political statement. So really, yes, queer is absolutely political. Black is political. Latinx is political. Gay and lesbian were absolutely political at the time. And now we kind of think not much of it in terms of those words themselves. So to just that piece, I think we need to think much more broadly about what it means to be political or apolitical when we're talking about identity and lived experience. To the next piece of that, you know, I think it's helpful just in writing and research to have some of these umbrella terms, but they absolutely don't work in any sort of real sense, you know, particularly because they do have these things about them that only work for those using them. Older people in our communities don't necessarily attach themselves to queer because of the way it was violently used against them. Younger people than I may be using words that I don't even know and haven't heard of. So they might think that I'm like fuddy-duddy for even saying queer, you know, like we don't know. I mean, the fact that I just said fuddy-duddy, you know, like.
It's like the old person trying to be hip. Right. I'm queer. I'm like,
what up, kids? I'm queer too. You know, so like.
It's rad to be queer.
Right. Exactly. And they might be like, dude, we're using lesbian again, so just drop it. Like,
right. Gay has come back as like a catch-all term.
Which, back to Bulldog, so just
yeah.
It's funny to me how many back to Bulldog.
It's funny to me how many people use gay in a catch-all way that are not right. Gay men. You know?
Right. Yeah, that's true too. That's true. So it doesn't work perfectly, you know, it really doesn't. I mean, especially because we usually say queer and trans, but okay, well, these two things are certainly not the same. We use it with women and femmes, and it's like, this is not interchangeable by any stretch of the imagination, women and femmes, this huge category, you know, women, this huge category. So. I mean, I'm certainly at fault for it. And I try when I use these kind of blanket terms to say, hey, this is what I'm meaning and I know it's imperfect. But I do think, and you and I have talked about this one-on-one, that the more language we develop, as much as we might roll our eyes or lose track of new languaging, is so extremely helpful. I mean, it's just so extremely helpful. I have been really helped by people of my own age, people in the generation above me, and people in the generation that came after me, by words like non-binary, ideas about this non-binary femness, that you can be non-binary and femme, genderqueer, and then some specific ethnic kind of terminology too, like not me personally, but Two-Spirit and terms coming out of Hawaii and those kinds of things are so incredibly helpful. So while we fall back on blanket terms like women and femmes and Latinx and queer, trans, I think that that's okay as long as we're prefacing it with this is what we mean, as long as we're being culturally responsible how and when we use it and why, not just out of sort of laziness. And then as long as we're also acknowledging how important it is that we have all of this new terminology and old terminology that talks to specific experiences that are more intersectional.
I think there's that's some of the confusion sometimes is we're so careful with our language that people get into these ever longer circumlocutions about, you know, people who XYZ, and it's, you know, it, because we can't just say
yes,
gay people or yeah, women, or, you know, we get, so it's, there's this duality, there's this conflict between using a term that's too simple and, you know, it's almost like we're afraid to get canceled if we don't include every single facet of the identity that could theoretically be in the group we're talking about.
I felt like I needed to drink to that, but all I have is this witch's tea that's unbrewed, but I'll just pretend like...
Is that sponsor placement?
I mean, this is Bright Witch Brews. Get yourself some Ritual at Dawn.
They have not paid for product placement.
They have not paid. So a friend just sent this to me. I don't know which one. If you sent me this tea, holler at your boy, Midnight Cauldron, because I don't know who sent this. Thank you so much. I'm excited. What were we talking about?
We're talking with Bridey Harris about queer Black lives, queer identity, theory, all sorts of stuff, and tea. I want to talk a little bit about queer Black lives, trans Black lives, as we've said, we're using these terms synonymously or not. You know, let's just kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. What would you like me to specifically?
So, you know, there is, and it's interesting, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we would say, you know, the LGBTQ community is thought of as predominantly white.
Yeah.
And I think that that stereotype for most people has been shattered, and people really, really, really love to remind each other that Pride was started by trans women of color. That is often where people's education stops. They know that, you know, a trans woman of color threw the first rock at Stonewall, but there's a lot more to this history than that.
Yeah, so I think the first thing I want to say quickly is that because our communities, including our social media spheres, are sometimes these echo chambers, that you and I may think that that generally people have shed this idea that being gay and lesbian, queer and trans, bisexual, etc., is mostly white, may really not be true, because we're seeing what our friends are talking about. And of course, all of our friends are like, you know, don't you dare forget that, you know, Black trans women started, you know, the Stonewall was a riot, the first gay pride was a riot, and that actually may not be common knowledge at all. So I think it's important to continue to remind people of that. But to your main point, it's so much bigger than that. I mean, so much bigger. We could take it all the way back to many other continents, you know, but we won't.
But you can go to another continent, that's fine.
I mean, there's all of this proof coming out that even when colonization was occurring on the west side of the African continent, that people were removing or hiding evidence of same gender loving relationships, multiple gender identities, multiple kinds of relationships and sexualities that are beyond our own languaging and our own formations of gay, lesbian, bisexual, poly, et cetera, you know? So queer people were on the boats of enslavers. Queer people have been on boats of their choosing, such as people who have emigrated to the United States, you know, for hundreds of years. So being queer has never ever been synonymous with whiteness at all. So we can say that there. And then in terms of just what Black, Brown, Indigenous persons have brought to queer life in these here United States is immeasurable, far beyond any kind of leading war cry on Stonewall. I think one of the reasons we like to go back to that moment is because that's the moment that has, in terms of the white imagination, most benefited gays and lesbians and bisexual folks and trans people today, you know? So it's kind of like, look at all this privilege we have, but really let's take a moment, you know, and just thank our foremothers at Stonewall, you know? So it becomes sort of classless actually, and just going back to this one moment, and it's like, you're probably mid-sentence saying, yes, girl, don't forget Stonewall. And it's like literally every word coming out of your mouth has been stolen by from Black queer femme spaces.
So two things about that. One, I think one of the reasons we like to hold up this narrative is it fits well in with the American exceptionalism. And yeah. This whole idea that, you know, we need to deal with individuals. There's not a system, you know, there's this invisible system we can't see. Well, mm-hmm. We're not going to worry about that. All it takes is one Rosa Parks sitting down on a bus, one Marsha Johnson throwing a rock, you know, one person can make a difference. And it's like, yes, but if they're supported by a movement that's going to organize behind them. So I think that's part of it. And then you're talking about appropriation. So, yeah. You know, it's interesting, you know, this, the happenstance that Stonewall is this incident that is very important. And I'm not trying to say it wasn't, but Black and queer people of color's culture in America has been very tied, at least to some degree, to drag and the ball scene. Mm-hmm. And that's been a leading engine. I'm going to have to start this over because I feel like I'm coming up with the worst words here. I'm going to start that whole sentence over, and I'm going to sound so much smarter.
No way. Earlier I said fuddy-duddy, so don't you dare erase that. We're in this together.
The only problem is, like, I know I have to go back and edit because of the feedback. So it's like, I'm like, oh, I'll just do all this. Like, on my $10 software.
We'll get through this together.
So we're talking about Stonewall and how, you know, on the one hand, it's a narrative that fits very well into the American, the greater narrative of American exceptionalism. One person can make a difference. You know, Rosa Parks sits down on the bus, Marsha Johnson throws a brick through a window, and lo and behold, there's change. And we forget about, you know, the boycott that came after the bus, the organizing, the gay liberation front groups that sprung up across the country following Stonewall that really pushed that difference. But the cultural piece of this is really important too. And I learned a few years ago that I was taking a course on American musical history. And it wasn't until then that I was sort of like, oh, wow, every musical tradition in America ties back to African and African-American experience in some way. And I'm not exaggerating there. It all kind of ties back to that. And that's very similarly the case in queer and LGBT culture, that people of color and Black people, and particularly Black people and people of color in the drag scene and the ballroom scene, have been a driving force in that culture. And what sometimes we perceive down, you know, we're sometimes consuming culture that's two or three steps removed from that. So we have no idea, you know, we have no idea that that's where it's, we're listening to or watching something that's a reaction to someone else's reaction to what was going on in that. I don't have a question there, but am I right? Is that true?
Yes. Yes. No, I mean, more than a part, you know, the ball scene, houses, drag balls, this is something that started in the Harlem Renaissance, you know, and then which was all Black queer, you know, Black gay men, Black queer people mothering other, you know, Black queer folks. And Black women. I mean, the Harlem Renaissance was queer and femme. Are we cursing? I didn't ask you ahead of time.
PG-13.
Queer and femme as F, you know?
The F, of course, standing for femme.
The F standing for femme. Yes, thank you. So, and then there's a revival of this a few decades later on the coast, where, again, Black and brown youth, majority youth, majority in city spaces, in coastal cities, majority experiencing poverty, racism, police brutality, homophobia, transphobia, femphobia, join one another in a alternative to the violence of their community on home spaces and the violence of the outside world, and create new languages of speaking with one another, new modes of being. So again, how Black gay men are sort of mothering a new generation during the Harlem Renaissance, we see rag moms, house moms, you know, mothers and fathers who are taking care of young Black and brown youth in these communities. And through that, I mean, all of this symbolism and signification comes with words that we now use today as if they have no political meaning whatsoever, with costumery and fashion, and a subversion to high forms of grotesque forms of capitalism, you know, things that were so unachievable suddenly become queered and subverted to actually signify these spaces. So you get the House of Dior, right? The House of Chanel, you know? So these become ours suddenly. And these violent spaces actually become very safe spaces with alternative kinds of mothers and fathers and children and fashion and ownership and language. So then now you may go into any sort of predominantly white bar across the United States and hear some of the same language and some of these same events without any person of color in the room, you know, and with no awareness, or worse, intentional removal of those who actually began this, and it becomes reclaimed. I think that there's more and more knowledge around this with some of the new, certainly with social media, and then some of the new shows and movies that are out there and highlighting some of these scenes and the histories of them and the importance. But even so, you see a lot of this kind of appropriation under the guise of appreciation as well.
And is some of the inclusion then of artists of color, does it sometimes come up as almost a modern form of blackface, where it's, you know, one of the things with blackface and vaudeville, a lot of the actors were Black. and they would put on blackface because they weren't black enough for the audience, you know? So I feel like I see that sometimes with shows where we want to see queer people of color, but you know, they're not putting on a genuine, they're putting on a performance primarily for the benefit of a white audience.
And we can harken back again to the decades of the decade of the Harlem Renaissance, where you see black queer men and women and non-binary folks performing in clubs where black people are not even allowed to enter. You know, so blackness has always been a tool, period, like hard stop, like a farm tool, chattel slavery, and then a tool of consumption, or, you know, so it's like entertain us either through music or dance or theater, entertain us through sport, where we see black bodies being, I mean, almost grotesque in terms of images of the slave block, you know, where you see these men being measured for wingspan and these kinds of things that are mind-boggling, you know, in terms of sports. Language, like we just talked about, the consumption of language, even with the removal of black people, it's like there's none in the room, but everybody is trying to sound and look black. You know, no one wants to be black, no one wants to be killed by the police, but everyone wants to say, yes, girl, you know? So, yeah, yes, yes.
And it's not only a modern occurrence. This is something that as long as there have been black people in America, which has been as long as there's been America, there's been this just really strange, parasitic relationship, really. There's not a lot of benefit. So there's using people for labor, using people for culture, and I'm just saying what you just said, which is that people are appreciating it's every attempt to appreciate it is more of an appropriation.
And honestly, like, when did we ask anyone to appreciate it? That's always sort of the defense. Like when you call somebody out, they say, well, what is that? What is the phrase? Like, is the best form of flattery?
Imitation is the most sincere form of flattery.
Yeah, imitation. I kept wanting to say mockery is the best form of now I can't speak, of flattery, because it is mockery, you know?
We're a great pair.
I would have been better with a little champagne, but this is how you got me, sober and tongue-tied. You're welcome. To my point, you hear that a lot. When you call someone out, they say, well, I'm appreciating. I just love it, you know? And it's like, oh, and? We literally have not asked you to do that. Like, imagine if I went out to the salon right now and got my hair straightened, colored light blonde, ash brown, got your same haircut, and showed up at your house and was like, I just wanted you to know that I like your haircut. And it's like, why would you do that? Why? What are you doing? This is next level stalker, actually. Except instead of one-on-one, it's a whole peoples, a diasporic entire people, the majority of the earth, you know? Like, if I did that to even one person, they would be like, on no planet is this a compliment. And the fact that you just gaslighted me by saying, I just stole your whole entire look because I like it so much, is creepy and deranged. You know, and we can see that very easily when we're talking on an individual basis, you know, and now we're actually speaking about a whole group of people. Don't appreciate us at all. Just go about your business, you know. Let us live, let us breathe, let us have our culture, let us have our food, let us have everything that you get to have. That white people in America, that cis people in America, that heterosexual people and heteronormative people just have on their own, you know? That was a little tangential, but essentially just like stop gaslighting Black people and queer people.
It's a little bit how I feel about the word. I feel a little bit like that about the word woke. When I hear white people referring to themselves as woke, I just cringe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's like, say that in your own vernacular. Right. There's no need to say woke. That's not even my vernacular. I don't say it, you know? I was raised in the country by a very lovely little Jewish woman. I say verklempt, you know, like I don't walk around saying I'm so woke, and neither need you, you know? Yeah, it's a whole trip.
I'll try it again. Can you tell me about your new project, 1.5 Femmes Against Fascism?
Absolutely. So it's 1.5 Femmes Against Fascism. And the 1.5 is just a little bit of a cheeky way of acknowledging the feminist and masculinity-ness of us all, but it's not really, you know, wholly, we're not wholly one sort of thing. Dr. J and I, Dr. J being my co-host of the show 1.5 Femmes, you know, so often we'll joke at the beginning of each segment, like, today I'm the one femme, Dr. J is the half, tonight I'll be the 0.75, you know, or I'll have my little butt shirt on, and it's like, I'm still femme, but I'm trying to lie.
If I had been in the naming room, I would have definitely recommended something around Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I mean, I feel like there's something there. But that's why I was not invited to that meeting.
Okay. Yeah, so the 1.5 Femmes started because just this moment of racial uprising in the middle of a global pandemic. And Dr. Jakia Marie and I are both educators, researchers, and you know, in my past, I've done a lot of organizing and street activism, but because of the nature of this moment with this global pandemic, and because a lot of my sort of street forms of activism are a little bit behind me, and I do other sorts of activist work, you know, as an activist researcher, activist scholar, we were both really struggling with what can we do right now in this moment that is accessible, educational, needed, necessary, and that can start conversations amongst sometimes disparate groups. And we didn't want to waste a lot of time on professionalism and production. So we thought, you know, let's just get on Facebook Live. We joked for a long time that we would have a podcast, and we had all kind of names. You don't want to know all of them, but the most wholesome was 1.5 Femmes, and we added Against Fascism because F fascism, and again, the F stands for femmes. and we, you know, this all happened the day before our first segment, essentially. We put a list of topic ideas that we felt we needed to talk about, such as white and white folks, how to leverage your privilege, mental health in a moment of racial uprising and immense grief, the liberation of queer and trans people during a racial uprising when Black Trans Lives Matter gets ignored largely. Trying to think of some of our other topics, conversations around anti-capitalism, conversations around Black women, Black and Black femmes, and the use of femme and the erotic in the movement for Black lives, the history of movement, the issues of white America focusing on lootings and riots, even though they are sorely lucky that we don't just burn the whole thing to the ground, you know. So all of those kinds of topics. And what we do is we have usually about two guests or conversation partners join us for each segment who have some lived experience and or professional training in that topic. And we just have a very casual conversation fishbowl. And then people join us live with questions, and we try to get to their questions during the show. And they're usually about an hour and a half.
There's been a lot of, I'll probably just ask you to kind of reflect this question in your answer. There's so much feedback. There's been a lot of organizing. There's been a lot of shows, a lot of groups that have popped up in reaction, which is great. Do you feel like they're, you know, sometimes I look at the thing, sometimes I look at all of the things that have popped up in reaction and it seems chaotic and you've got people going in different directions and disagreeing with each other and fighting with each other. But at the same time, it's also, that's, I guess maybe that's very organic, you know, or that's the nature of an organic community response. Do you feel like this response is going to have lasting staying power?
So I think often what people forget when there is a moment like this, they see it just for the moment itself. They don't see how this moment is one point on a long, long history of the movement for Black Lives, which includes the revolt of enslaved persons on the continent, throughout the Caribbean, in the middle of the ocean, the Atlantic, you know, on plantations, enslaved revolts on plantations. It includes resisting Jim Crow, resisting redlining, the entire civil rights movement, the Black Panthers, you know, Black queer movements. It includes Stonewall, because that is part of the movement for Black Lives. It includes, you know, all of the protests around the events of Ferguson and the formation of Black Lives Matter, which is also a Black and queer movement moment for the movement for Black Lives. So there is always forward movement. There is always change. This is certainly going to create change. This has already created change. I think one thing that activists, organizers, and most people who just experience life as a racialized person in the United States, what they know is that those who believe in freedom cannot rest. So while there is constant movement and constant progress, there is also always more right over the next mountaintop, you know? So it's, especially during the civil rights movement, there was a lot of talk of a certain particular place that we're going to get to and everything is going to be well, this beautiful land. But in, I think, reality, it's like, yes, okay, we've made some of these benchmarks, but what we're really calling for is the total destruction of white supremacy and fascism and patriarchy and homophobia and transphobia. And here's my cat. So I don't know if I'm answering your question as much as I'm just saying, yes, this moment is going to have long lasting effects. And also it is one moment in a long history of Black protest and Black education and Black efforts, to improve Black life, here in the United States throughout the diaspora and on the continent.
Thank you for joining me. I feel like that's a good stopping point. I think we've kind of been hit a lot of topics today. I don't know if I got to any of the questions I thought I would ask, but it's been a great conversation, and we'll probably come back and do another one. When and how can people enjoy One and a Half Femmes Against Fascism? You're on mute.
1.5 Femmes Against Fascism, or as we call it, 1.5 Faff. And by we, I mean, I just literally only said that just now, so I hope it sticks. Dr. J, if you're hearing this, we call it 1.5 Faff now. 1.5 Faff has an Instagram page, so you can find us at 1.5 Femmes Against Fascism on Insta, or the best way is our Facebook page, so 1.5 Femmes Against Fascism on Facebook, and it's from Facebook Live that we do our segments, which happen about every other day. So yesterday we did one on mental health in the movement for Black Lives, and then tomorrow we'll be speaking with a painter and multimedia artist, as well as a poet and organizer, talking about the uses of healing art and song in protest.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining me today, Bridie.
Thank you so much for having me.